Exo Skin. If you go to our partners page, click on the banner, you can get 20% off using the code TRN.
Hey, we just had Carl Speed Goat Metzler on, and his podcast will be released in a couple weeks. But what we talked about was efficiency on the course, in and out of aid stations. And when you wear the right gear, the right socks, the right shirt, the right shorts, you are good to go. You don't have to make changes throughout the race.
Efficiency equals faster times. Get yours at exoskin.com or go to our partners page, click on that banner and get 20% off.
Put in code TRN. Everlywell, lab testing made easy, results you can understand.
I decided to take the heart health test, which is a kit that they deliver to you in the mail, comes very quick. It is a very easy to use step-by-step instructions. There's a video if you want to watch a video. But I decided to put this to the test. I got my results back. I know what the numbers they gave me. 2 weeks later, I went and took a real lab test that was ordered by my doctor where they fill two giant syringes full of blood. And I got those results back just yesterday.
And I've compared, Scott. I've seen them, and I am blown away.
You were pretty surprised.
They were
right on the money.
Every one of them.
Within one or two digits off. And so we know that they're reliable. They have over 35 tests that you can take, from testosterone. There's a men's health test.
Lyme's disease test as well.
Yeah, a folic acid test. There's 35 different ones. If you go to everlywell.com, you can look at all of those tests. And they're very affordable. It's private. They also have people that, if you have questions about the test, they reach out.
Super relevant, especially when people are taking charge of their own health, like athletes that listen to this.
You go to everlywell.com/TRN and use the code TRN, and you can get 15% off your first test.
Everlywell.com/TRN for 15% off.
Yeah, thank you, Don. You know, I mean, I didn't know what it was going to be like. You know, you sound like a nice guy on this podcast, but
I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards, and
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
What are you balancing your checkbook over there, AJW? What's going on?
You're
recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name's Scott Ward.
Scott, that was a pretty casual intro. You just kind of...
It rolls off my tongue. I've done it once.
Hummed and hawed through that. Myself. And I'm Don Freeman. I'm with Scott today.
You are, as always. And we're turning back the time clock and coming back to one of the first people that we ever interviewed when we started podcasting. This is Ray Zahab. And Ray has a really interesting story and a phenomenal, even better story of what his mission is in life. And we're going to get into that in a little bit. But we'll link this in the show notes as well. But RayZahab.com, you can go to his website, ImpossibleToPossible.com, which kind of tips our hat at what this podcast is about. We've been in touch with Ray. We actually bumped into Ray and his wife up at Bigfoot 200 last year.
Two years ago.
When Ray's wife was running the Bigfoot 200 and Don was running the Bigfoot 200, and we committed to each other, hey, we need to do a podcast, and we haven't done it until now. But Ray recently is very active on social media, and Ray posted something a couple months ago that just resonated with me, and I thought, we need to get Ray back on and talk about this. And this is what Ray said. Ray, I don't even know if you remember this.
Welcome to the podcast, Ray.
Yeah.
Have I been talking?
And we're about out of time, Ray. So.
Thanks for the chat.
Yeah.
Talk soon.
This is what he posted on social media. He said, running is your biggest teacher, and that many people underestimate themselves.
You're pointing to me, Scott. I was turned off. I love that comment, and I think that kicks us off for a great conversation. Ray, what did you mean when you wrote that?
Well, I mean, I hope I expanded on it a little bit more than that. But basically, for me, personally, and I think I speak for a lot of people that, you know, have taken on any sort of case, we learn so much from it. Right? I mean, we really do. And for me, on the journey that I've been on, running has sort of in a non-planned way, taught me so much about myself, taught me so much about us as human beings, about my world, about the world that I live in, the places that I go. You know, but most importantly, it's taught me to never underestimate what I'm capable of doing. Because, you know what it's like? When you are running, or you are, so many of the people that listen to your podcast, I'm assuming, are trail runners, and they do trail races, and they go and do ultra marathons, etc. You can rise to a ridiculous occasion when you're doing this stuff, whereas when you're at home training, it's hard sometimes to get the miles in. But boy, on race day, you can run 200 of them, or whatever it is that you have to do that day. Like, you make shit happen, right? And running, I think, spells that out so clearly. Like, when we're on a run, you can be having a horrible day. You go for a run, you feel like $1 million. You solve the world's problems in a 30-minute run, right? I mean, that's just where you go with your head. So your mind is opened up to the potential and the possibilities when you're running. And of course, I've spent, in kilometers, 15,000 kilometers, I've ran across deserts all over this world, spending a lot of that time alone. And with plenty of time to think, realizing that it's running that's taught me the most about myself than anything else I do. I mean, just everything about running, everything about challenging myself, everything about not underestimating myself. All of these things have come from running.
Yeah, spending time alone as being a teacher, that's interesting. That normally you think, I need to sit in a classroom environment, or I need to get in front of someone to have them teach me. But spending time by yourself, going through different circumstances, and most of the teaching out there is done, it's not easy. The teacher out there isn't a very compassionate and kind teacher. Sometimes sometimes she hammers you with a lesson that we can learn so much just being with ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, basically, look at the thing as a whole. I mean, for anybody that's out there, and it's a very relatable thing to take on a risk or to take on a challenge. So, I spent the first 30 years of my life talking myself out of doing anything risky or taking any chances or trying anything because I was so afraid of failing. I mean, that was, I just was afraid of what other people would think. I was afraid of failure. And what I learned through running, for example, it's just one of the many things, is that I would commit to doing these crazy ultra marathons when I was racing. I would commit to doing these races. And it was like a risky proposition in those days because it was new to me. Everything was new to me. I was new to running. I was new to everything. But I'm like, hey, I'm going to enter this race that's in Morocco. And I have no idea what the hell is going to happen, but I'm going to go and do it, right? And you commit to this thing, you enter this thing, you train and prepare for it, then you go and do it, and you can't believe that you did it. And there's a part of you, or at least for me, that says, Frank, I mean, how did I do that? I don't even know how I got it done. I mean, it's just, you almost feel like you don't deserve it because you don't even know how you did it, But that's the human capacity, right, to rise to a challenge. And I think that running, it's in the simplest of terms, it shows us these things about ourselves. Do you dig what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
It's like just from the start, just from the get-go, saying, I'm going to enter whatever it is, a 100-mile running race. I'm going to enter this. I'm going to commit to do this thing. Well, it's a huge commitment, right? And especially if you're not used to making big commitments or taking chances, that's a pretty big chance.
Hey, right?
And then you go and do it, and whatever the outcome, doesn't matter. It's that you went out and tried, right? You jumped into the pool without checking if it was warm first.
Ray, you mentioned for the first 30 years you were risk averse. Was this a light switch that you flipped on, or was it a slower evolution to making these impossible risks?
I think it was a slower but very normal evolution and a very regular evolution. And what I mean by that, I'm 50 now, right? So when I was in school, I make the joke that I think they graduated me out of high school. This is pre MS-DOS for anybody that's even my age that even knows what that is. I mean, there's no computers, right? School systems grades were all still done by hand. And I think they graduated me, embellished grades just to get rid of me because I was so bad in school, right? Like, I was just that guy. And so then with my diploma off, I went to community college, and promptly dropped out. I was just completely unmotivated when I was younger. And as far as physical, sports and all that stuff, forget it, dude. I grew up in a small town in Ontario. Hockey is like the thing, obviously, football in the U.S. We had a football team in our high school. I was so afraid of that. I was with phys ed because I didn't want to go into the locker room with all these guys who were actually sporty, right? And then there was me, you know, and I just never felt like it. So everything for me from the get-go was this negative self-perception that I think a lot of us carry around, and you fake being happy on the outside. And I spent 25 years doing that and was completely unfulfilled and unsatisfied with it. And just like many people, you guys included, I'm sure, at some point you go through a point in your life when you're like, well, everything kind of sucks right now. Like you're not feeling it, right? We all go through low points in our lives, and you know, like a depression or whatever it is you want to call it. We all experience that at one time or another in our lives. And I was just like tired of feeling that way all the time. And so I just didn't know what my way out would be. And I have a younger brother who's an amazing climber and mountain biker and runner. And he was doing all this really cool stuff. And the more of the stuff he was doing, the more inspired I was by how confident he became in the things he was doing. And I thought, wow, maybe if I did the same things he did, you know, my life would be different. And I was like, I was an unhealthy guy. I was smoking a pack a day, you know, sometimes two packs a day, drinking my face off, doing all the things that a lot of us did when we were younger. But I was lucky. I had this younger brother who was way more smart than I am and was like, yeah, dude, give this a try. So, you know, it took me a few years to finally commit. And then in January 2000, I basically, that's it. I changed my life. I quit smoking. I said I was going to do everything he did. My life changed in a very short time. You know, over the period of 3-4 years, I realized I had the same engine that my brother did to do these really long endurance things. And then I entered my first running race, which was the Yukon Arctic Ultra, 100-miler, and I won it. And I mean, I shouldn't have, but I did, you know, and I just, you know, I never won anything like that my entire life. It felt really, really great to be like a winner. I felt, I'd never felt those feelings in my life before. I'd never felt as invincible and as confident, if that's not too over the top, as I did that day when I finished the Yukon Arctic Ultra. I never felt that way in my entire life until I'm like 35 and this thing happens, right? And I thought to myself, I'm never underestimating myself again. And it's not just me, it's that people in general, everyone has this in them. They have that ability to be extraordinary. And it's, I don't give a shit if it sounds cheesy. That's what I believe. I believe that people underestimate themselves. It's not about being, you know, a fantastic, amazing runner or whatever. It's whatever you derive your passion from and fuels you. That's where you gain the most knowledge in your life, because you got one shot at life, right? And that's the way I look at it. I'm living my life. The glass is not like half full now. It's overflowing. Like I just crank in the throttle full bore every day. You know?
Hey, Ray, earlier you said you have the same engine as your brother. Where does that engine live?
Well, my brother lives in Ottawa, in the nation's capital, and I live in Quebec, just across the border, in Chelsea, Quebec. Is that what you mean? Where does that engine live? Or you mean,
like, he's being a little more, like being more philosophical.
Yeah, yeah. does it live below the...
Well, excuse me, Mr. Fancy Pants. Okay.
That's right. It was actually Scott's question. I robbed it from his screen. Hey, so does that engine live inside of our heart or inside of our head?
You know what? It's a combination of factors. You know, I've said, you know, I've been quoted by this and people laugh at it when I say this, but it, the stuff that we do, greatest challenges we face, 90% mental, the other 10% is all in our heads. We know if we're going to run 100 miles, it's going to hurt. It's going to be hard to get ready for. It's very difficult to train for, but you can overcome that physical part, right? You can get through it because you accept it. It's part of doing an ultra marathon. It's your head that really, it's the commitment. It's the overarching ability to think and perceive that you can do this thing that really, really gets you to the finish line, right? So in everything that I was learning from my brother, like, for example, the very first thing that my brother, you know, sort of introduced me to in the outdoors was climbing, because that was the thing he's most passionate about, specifically ice climbing. So we did a lot of ice climbing together, and I'll never forget the first waterfall that I climbed with him, Frozen Waterfall, and I was on a top rope. I mean, it was very basic climbing. And I was probably 100 feet off the ground when I finally scampered over the top of this thing, in which he was pulling on the rope more than I was climbing, because I just didn't have the strength at the time to do it under my own volition. So anyway, I get up over the top of the thing, and I look down at him, and he said, "You did it." And I'll never forget that day thinking, this is what it feels like to be a Mount Everest climber. You see, because I was out there, and I'm doing this thing, I realized that the greatest things that we achieve in our lives are truly relative to us as individuals. It's not about winning the ultramarathon. It's not about winning the race. It's about participating and doing something for you personally that is a win. You know what I'm saying? Like, I knew that day, like, it was the greatest thing I'd ever done, was climbing that frozen waterfall with my brother that day. Like, I could not believe it from where I was before in my head, where I was before, like, you know, telling myself I suck all the time, to being able to do this thing with my brother. It just automatic, a switch flicked in my head. And I was like, wow, I mean, this is amazing, right? And that was sort of the beginning, and then it led to the Yukon Arctic and everything else that happened after that.
You know, I love your point. As we do these runs, we're all winners, whether you're, you know, first, middle, or dead last, it doesn't matter. And Scott and I have had the wonderful opportunity to announce these races and some of these endings, and seeing the special moment on everyone's face, mm-hmm. as they come through, whether they're first, middle, or last, it doesn't matter. It's super special. It's super awesome. In fact, the person at the very end, as we've all been to races, gets the most ovation and the most respect and the most celebration, because they persevered whatever they went through to finish. And I think that's what's so cool about our sport, is that regardless of whether you come in, there's a lesson for all of us out there, and there's a great victory waiting for all of us, and it doesn't matter your time. And that's what I just love about this. There, if you don't make it to the podium, it's not like you weren't successful. Everyone's successful, and one might argue,
yes,
the person at the end.
Sorry to interrupt you. My point is, it's a race. So by definition, somebody's got to win it. And that's insanely impressive, right? Like, that's ridiculous. Like Courtney, for example, it's mind-blowing, right? And what she's doing. And so seeing these people, these elite athletes, winning these races is incredible and inspiring. But also, what I'm saying is, to the individuals that are doing it, and that's the beauty of running, and especially, I think, trail running and ultra running, what it does to the individual, it enables the individual to see in themselves that relative to them, that the experience that they have, like the person who completes the first 5K and never thought they'd ever get off the couch and do something like that. Like, they may as well have won the Boston Marathon in their mind, because that's how it feels, right? Yeah. So the beauty of our sport is that it enables people to achieve a personal best or whatever it is they're looking for. You can get that through ultra running and trail running, because it's so pure. It's you and the ground. That's what you're dealing with, and your head and your legs, right? It's so, that's why I think it's so awesome. It teaches us things.
You know, internally, when you accomplish that goal, whether it's a 100-foot frozen waterfall or your first 5K, internally, you have these feelings that, you know what, I am worth something. I have the ability to do hard things. But I think externally, at least in our community, the first thought that we have is, I need to share this feeling with those people around me. And I think that's one of the things that has impressed us about you, Ray, over the years, is, you know, you have discovered what running has taught you and continues to teach you, and you want to share that. And that's where you have devoted the most of your life now, to sharing that. Can you talk about how that evolved, this whole thing of impossible to possible business?
For sure. So basically, you know, in a nutshell, what happens, I was racing, I was doing ultra marathon races all over the world between 2004 through to 2006. And then, you know, obviously, as you guys know, and we talked about this before, that's when shortly after that, Charlie, Kevin, and I ran 4,500 miles across the Sahara Desert. And in that 111 days that it took us to run across the Sahara, I'd spent more time on my feet than I had pretty much in my entire life, and realized that that's when it was really solidified in my mind that really the only limits that we have are the ones, honestly, I believe, that people that we put on ourselves. I mean, like, look, it's relative to us as individuals, but we could do extraordinary things. It's in your own terms. And so from that, running the Sahara experience, it taught me so much about North Africa and the people of North Africa, and about Charlie, Kevin, and I, and about just so many lessons that were learned there that I thought, wow, I mean, I'm a voracious learner. Like, I wanted to learn. I my entire school career, I didn't give a shit about learning. I didn't care about learning. I just was disinterested. But here in the Sahara Desert, I'm learning from the indigenous people of the Northern Sahara things about agriculture, things about social economics, things about life in general that I otherwise never had the capacity to absorb in a classroom. And I thought, there's something to this. There's something to this. So two things I knew. After running the Sahara, I knew that I did not want to go back to racing, that I wanted to put my eye towards doing expeditions. I wanted to cross as many of the large deserts on the planet as I could, but as well do unsupported Arctic and Antarctic expeditions. So I've been to the South Pole unsupported. I've done multiple Arctic and Siberia expeditions, self-contained, unsupported, meaning I haul all my supplies. And I, of course, crossed all of these other large deserts, the Atacama Desert, the Gobi Desert. And I'm doing these things in the time of year, for example, the Gobi Desert or the Atacama, I cross them in the middle of summer. So I'm experiencing the desert when it's most deserty, right? So in running the Sahara, we were able to share this through a live website. And then there was social media came along. And then there was better satellite communication. And I thought, wow, how cool would it be to take my expeditions and bring those expeditions into classrooms and have the classrooms come onto the expeditions with me virtually using technology. So I started building websites based on my expeditions. So my expeditions would become a thread. The run itself would be a thread that would weave together stories of the place that I was in. So when I ran across the Gobi Desert, I ran that solo in 2013. We strung together those 2,000 plus kilometers into stories of the culture of Mongolia. So the different locations that I would run through Mongolia would become little vignettes, little stories, photos and video captures that would appear on a live website so that students could then participate and ask questions of me while I was out there. But further to that, and simultaneous to me doing my expeditions, and stop me if I'm making my description too long, I started a nonprofit organization based in California with my best friend Bob Cox and my wife Kathy, and the organization is called Impossible to Possible. And what we do is, once or twice a year, we take a group of youth between the ages of 16 and 21 on an Impossible to Possible expedition where they become the adventurer that's connecting their expedition to their peers in classrooms around the world. So we'll get thousands and thousands of students that will tap into these expeditions. And it's 100% free. Like, there's no cost. So I've never charged schools to communicate with me on my own expeditions. And I certainly don't charge these youth ambassadors. That's the what we call the kids that go on the expeditions. We don't charge them to go on the expeditions. That we cover everything, including gear. And then schools can tap in to the curriculum 100% for free. And we're all volunteers. You know, I'm a volunteer in this organization. So we do it because we're so passionate about it. And I've seen over the 15 youth expeditions that we've done over the years, and 15 of my own, these are major expeditions that take sometimes a couple of months to complete. We've seen that connection to schools and that reciprocation from students that it's really a mind shift. It's altering for them to experience an adventure, whether through the eyes and feet of their peers or through my own expeditions, and be able to be inspired to go out and do their own things.
I have about 25 questions, but I'm going to start with this one. How is it that you get the school's attention or attraction to this? So you've got this idea. How do you get them to come on board and to make it part of their daily curriculum each day?
Okay. So when we started it in 2008, so running the Sahara finished 2007. I mapped out I was going to go to the South Pole in 2009. I had some Canadian projects that I was doing as well in 2008 and in late 2007. So in that time frame, when we started Impossible to Possible, because we started it simultaneously, for our first youth expedition, we worked with Apple Distinguished Educators. Through the ADE program at Apple Education, we worked with, we sort of went grassroots, guys. We tried to go top down. We approached school boards all over Canada, the Toronto District School Board, which is one of the largest school boards in North America. We contacted school boards in LA, and we were told by, well, it wasn't that we so much that we were told. It was basically, what strings are attached. There's got to be a string here somewhere. Can't be free. It's impossible, right? And so we were like, no, I mean, this program, we're trying to get this thing off the ground. It's free. We're going to have a live website. It's going to be really cool. It's more resource material than it is solid curriculum. It does fall out of, it does fall out of the regular, the name escapes me, standardized model of education. But there's some stuff based chemist or your chemistry teacher or math teacher, you're going to find something on every youth expedition. You'll find that connect point that you can turn into an interesting story. So what we realized, we needed to go bottom up. So we started meeting these teachers, these ADEs and other teachers that were really into the experiential learning model. That is taking curriculum and reinventing it for your classroom. Or in some cases, if you're lucky, like if we were teaching, each youth expedition we go on has a different curriculum attached, right? So go to the Amazon jungle, we study biodiversity. Go to Rajasthan, we studied access to healthcare. Go to Tunisia, we studied water. So every time it was a different subject. And classrooms then, through these teachers, word gets around, they start telling their friends tell their friends. And we're at a point now where in the organization, we're planning our next youth expedition, which was supposed to take place this year, but we're actually going next year. And we're like, look, it's totally free. This is our address. If you want to be on board, we'd love to have you. Here's the website. Follow along and just join in. And there's like, it's just, we're simplifying it completely to how schools can get involved.
You know, Ray, sometimes we've already discussed, we put limits on ourselves. And it takes some experiences to break out of that, to realize that we have the spirit and the drive within us to accomplish it. But sometimes, and you just described a situation where other people put limits on you and say, that's not possible for you to do, or that's not going to work. There's got to be a catch to it. How do we ever overcome some of the limits that others put on us?
So if we had hours, I could tell you so many stories about when I started this Impossible Possible. So the way the business model works, again, it shouldn't work. I mean, basically I do my expeditions and, once a year I go on some expedition. So, you know, what was the last expedition? I attempted a crossing of Kamchatka Peninsula, middle of winter, unsupported coast to coast in Russia last winter. Okay. So I acquire sponsorship over the years and funding from partners that are totally on board with the projects I'm doing and they're digging it. And I use those expeditions now, my expeditions, as a platform to raise funding awareness and create new partnerships for Impossible to Possible. So one sort of feeds the other, right? But in the beginning, it's like the cart or the horse, right? So I come up with this idea, Impossible to Possible, with Bob and Kathy, and I'm like, okay, now we got to find funding. And I cannot tell you how many people told me. And these were like, you know, people in business that were business leaders that said, there is no business model. You're not going to make this thing work. It can't be free. There's no way, forget it, give up, you know, find another idea. And I just was like, no, this is what I want to do. This is what I'm going to do. And so what I've learned, and I was scared for sure. I mean, because I was like, I'm saying I can do it. Maybe I can't do it. Maybe all these people are right because they definitely are a lot smarter than I am, right? But what I realized is when you commit to something, when you truly commit to it, it's ridiculous what you can pull off and get done. And because I refused to take no for an answer, I wanted to do this thing. I so believed in what we were trying to do. We were successful. We scraped by. We got the first expedition done. We scraped by. We got the second expedition done. And it hasn't been easy. I mean, it's no easier now. I'll tell you that much. It's because everything's more expensive now. World economy is a lot more buoyant than it was 10 years ago. So things cost more. So it's more expensive to do, but we keep going. Bob and I laugh about it because it's like, we just keep hammering along, because once you decide that you're going to do something for yourself or you have a goal that you want to achieve, you don't entertain negative energy. You got to let that stuff go. The naysayers can say what they want. They can have their opinion and people can tell you you can do this or you can't do that, but it's up to you whether you digest what those people are saying. If you want to internalize it, it's on you. It's got nothing to do with anybody else. Nobody else is at fault. If people are saying, oh, it's impossible, forget it, you're a loser, right, or whatever, then they're not to blame. They're not the ones to blame. They can say what they want, but it's on us if we internalize it or we let it affect us, right? And over time, you just realize, yeah, it hurts sometimes to hear that stuff. But at the end of the day, the less you absorb of that stuff and the more you stay on your path and surround yourself with positive energy and with good people, amazing shit happens.
You know, and I think that all those that are listening have their own stories about this where, you know, they may have been a Cheeto-eating couch potato and they decided for whatever reason, I'm going to go run a 5K. And they had people around them going, dude, you're 400 pounds overweight. There's no way you can run a 5K. And they have to overcome that those negative comments from the people around them. And I think that you didn't mention this, but you had your wife and Bob around you that believed that you could do this also. And so you had a support crew that, you know, even if you do have some negative chatter from external sources that are telling you, no, you can't, yourself, you have to make a decision on whether you're going to believe them or not. But then you have put some important people around you that say, you know what, you don't listen to them. They remind you not to listen to them.
Yeah, but listen, I hope my point that I'm getting across here. Yes, it's great. You know, in the journey, you surround yourself with positive people or, you know, that's what you try to do. But at the end of the day, the buck stops with you. Like the people that are saying this to this person, oh, you're never going to run a 5K. Are you good? It's getting your head around the fact that, yeah, there's going to be those people always, but are you going to let them get in your head? Mm-hmm. Right? Are you going to listen to them? Because what they say, it's if you allow what they say to affect you. Yeah, like we're human beings. It's hurtful stuff, you know, when people say things like that. But it's, are we going to allow people to determine our course? Are we going to determine our course? You know what I'm saying? So, yes, in those early days, Bob and Kathy were there. But, hey, it's stressful, dude. I mean, you know, like you're starting this thing out and you are second guessing. You're wondering when, sure, Bob and Kathy, and then a million other people are saying don't do it, right? So it's like you're always going to be up against that. But it's that, do you allow it to affect you or get inside your head and be part of you? Or are you like, okay, thanks for opinion. I'm going down the track. I'm doing my thing now. Thank you. You know, and then the further down that line you get, the more you're going to surround yourself naturally, organically, or, you know, these other people come into the fray that are more like-minded, you know? Mm-hmm.
So you've taken the impossible business model and made it possible. Let's talk about how you select these student ambassadors. How do you find the character and the components that make a successful ambassador for you?
Well, and I want to say, you know, we made the impossible possible. It's not really, we don't think of it that way. We're not looking in the rearview mirror. We're always looking ahead as to what can we do next? How can we reinvent? How can we make the next youth expedition better? How can we still keep it free? It's super basic where we are in our heads with it. We don't try to overgrandize what we've done or what we're doing. This is our passion. And this is what we want to do and how we pick the youth ambassadors. So typically we'll do an announcement on Facebook or whatever, social media. And then it'll be over a 3 to 4 week period that the youth ambassadors have a chance to apply to go on a youth expedition. And from that pool of applicants, we have a selection committee that's made up of Bob Cox, his wife, Tria, our former youth ambassadors that are now alumni, that help in the selection process. And then they determine, I'm not involved in the selection process at all. And they determine based on the specific parameters of the expedition, who's going. But you know, it's amazing. And so inspiring is how many amazing young people there are out there. Like the applications, they tell me it's overwhelming. Like they get so many amazing kids applying for these expeditions. It's crazy. We take them all. If we can afford it, we take them all. But we can only do between 4 and 6, you know, on each expedition.
I'm interested in why you remove yourself from the selection process because you're so intimately involved in it. I have some ideas, but I'd like to hear from you. Why have you removed yourself?
Well, because it's not my role, and I'm the founder, you know, and I've been on the boards of various charities over the years and learned, you know, about process and stuff like that from being on the boards of these much, much larger charities than my own. And I just think it's just more clean. That's not my role. You know, Bob is an equal partner in this. He was there on day one. You know, Bob is it's 50-50 basically, you know? And so that's what Bob's, that's one of his things that he's very good at in the organization. My stuff's in the other areas, you know, as well, like planning and, you know, and all that sort of thing, logistics. So we each have our roles, you know, and I think it's really important that alumni in our organization have a big say in who goes on the next expedition, having, of course, them experienced the expedition.
What are some of the characteristics? I mean, are you looking for physical characteristics, like this person has the physical characteristics that they can make it physically from point A to point B on the expedition? Are you looking for the ones that are super, super mentally tough? Or are you looking for people that maybe haven't discovered that this type of an expedition is possible?
Could be anything. It all depends on the expedition. When we did, I'm just thinking here, when we did Peruvian Amazon, they were covering a lot of ground. They were running a lot. So obviously the youth ambassadors had to have a bit of a running background. When we did Lost Coast Trail in Northern California, studying ecosystem services, none of those kids were runners. You know, they were out there hiking. I might have been the youngest group. I can't remember. But they were out there. Some of them, I think, may have been actually runners, but not, they were not runners. Like, they weren't runners like the kids that went to Peru. Instead, it was their ability to be able to create educational content and commit to the curriculum that they were going to have to create every day, even when they were tired. So they have a job. It's not just running. It's sharing their story. And on that trip, it was especially difficult because they had to carry everything. Satellite equipment, all that had to be carried. So it was an unsupported trip. So it all depends on the expedition, the parameters of the expedition.
Do you have any stories that you can share with us? Some kids that had absolutely wowed you. It's like, I never knew that this person was capable. They didn't know. Let me tell you the story. Do you have any of those?
Oh, how many hours have you got? You know, when we went to Bolivia in 2010, let me just think now. Yeah, because I was in Siberia the same year. So I went across Lake Baikal in Siberia in 2010 in the winter. That was my expedition. And then we went to Bolivia later in the year in 2010. That's the way I have to do this. I'm thinking out loud on your podcast. That's just, you know, shows you how small my brain is. But anyhow, we studied, it was the International Year of Chemistry. So these youth ambassadors were running across the Bolivian Altiplano, like the largest salt expanse, flat of salt expanse on the planet. And they were gathering little mineral packets and stuff to conduct chemistry experiments later in the day, live to tape, all that stuff. So one of the youth ambassadors was from a remote First Nations community in Canada. That community had our youth ambassador, Brandon, had experienced some social issues in the past. But he was this amazing individual. And, you know, in his application, if I recall, it's been so long now, you know, everybody believed in Brandon on our team. And so anyhow, so he came on the youth expedition. He had a very hard time because, you know, all these kids were all coming from different places. I think we had, we had a couple of kids from the U.S. I think we had some others from maybe one from Toronto and South America. We had another and Brandon and from a cultural perspective and from how he grew up and where he came from, it was a completely different, everything was different. The social communications were different. The nuances of how they interacted were different. And we really weren't sure how things were going to work out. And these youth ambassadors gelled so well together and rallied around each other so well that Brandon went from sort of being in the background to being almost like a leader on the expedition. And by the time that trip was over, I was going somewhere a couple of years later, flying somewhere to go to a conference or something. And I opened up this magazine and there was an article about Brandon, and he was like a keynote speaker at this Me2We. I don't know if you guys have Me2We events there. The Kielbergers, if they do those in the U.S., but these are these massive rallies where they'll fill like a hockey arena with thousands and thousands and thousands of kids come from all these schools. There's this big fundraising day and they have all these stories. And Brandon was one of the speakers.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. You know, and this is just one of many stories like that. I mean, there's just so many stories like that where these youth ambassadors, they go on to do amazing things. You know, being in Brazilian rainforest and seeing these youth ambassadors, trekking through the deep Amazon from one indigenous community to the next, carrying all their stuff, learning about biodiversity, right, from the people obviously who live in the Amazon jungle, and knowing, like, imagine, you know, so you're 30 years old and something goes wrong way down the road, right, in life, and you're like, well, when I was 17 I hiked through the Amazon, so I think I got this problem sorted. You know what I mean? Like, they just, yeah, it opens their mind to the potential of what they can do as well.
And it opens you up to the world as well. It's just not this small town that you live in. There's actually other spots on this globe we're connected to, and they're not impossible to get to. They affect us, and we can affect them.
Absolutely.
Was your wife, when you started this whole thing, was she an endurance athlete, or did she follow in your footsteps?
So my wife is... an environmental scientist. I'm stumbling because I'm not exactly sure what she does. She does a bunch of really cool stuff. Very smart. Maybe she works for the CIA. I'm not sure. Right?
She doesn't listen to this.
Yeah, she. So when we first met, we met in early days. Like, I mean, I had nothing, and I sort of was kickstarting my life, and I had a futon in my mountain bike. I was racing mountain bikes in those days. And before I was a runner, I was racing mountain bikes for a few years. And, I had my mountain bike. I had my tiny little apartment, which incidentally, that was another sort of step into the future adventures that I would do, because my apartment that I rented was an old sandwich shop that had been renovated into an apartment in Chelsea, Quebec, where I live. And it was owned by the renowned polar explorer, Richard Weber, who is of all of my inspirations and great adventure heroes, he's like right at the top of the list. So, you know, Richard Weber has done unsupported expeditions to the South Pole. You just look him up, Richard Weber. You won't believe the stuff this guy's pulled off. So anyhow, Richard owned the apartment. And so he'd come over and he'd be telling me all these stories about expeditions he's been on, like crazy shit, going across from Russia over the polar ice cap to Canada, 110 days on the ice, unsupported, this kind of stuff, polar bears, millions of polar bear stories. And so, yeah, I'm segueing here completely and not answering your question. But so that's where I lived in those days. And so I bumped into Kathy, and she was already in her career as an environmental engineer at that point. She's a scientist, and I am like doing this other stuff, practically at middle age, restarting my life kind of thing. And we had running in common. So she was running 5 and 10 Ks. That was her thing. She enjoyed it recreationally. And I was, you know, starting this ultra marathon. I was racing ultras at that point. And here we are all these years later. And then now she's, one thing leads to another, and she gets into running these 200 mile things, and she loves them. And I saw you guys at Bigfoot, and, you know, she killed it at Bigfoot. Now she's going to Moab in a couple of weeks.
Oh,
you
wow.
know? She loves going to Candace's races because they're just amazing. They're so well organized and everything, you know?
Yeah, and she puts them together so that if you're motivated, you can finish it. There's enough time and enough support out there that any half trained athlete, if they're mentally strong, can get it done. I want to ask you about
she's an amazing race director. Doesn't get enough. Like, I mean, it's incredible what she's done and how she's basically created a sub industry in the trail running, you know, scene. It's really impressive.
Another great example of impossible to possible, right? I'm sure she had a lot of people saying,
really,
are you nuts? No
that.
One wants to run 200
think
miles.
Exactly. No one's going to want to run 200 miles and all the things that go with it. You know, you got to fly out there and you got to bring all your gear and you got to take a week off work and blah, blah, blah. It'll never work. Can you imagine? Now look at it.
And
you know, the races are super popular. You know, I have clients that I occasionally coach clients and stuff, but I have my own race series here in Quebec where we live. We have a couple of UTMB point races, and we tell all our runners, go and do one of these races in the States because they're amazing, you know? So, and she's not just getting that from us, she's getting it from everywhere. So you build it and they'll come, as they say in that baseball movie.
Yeah. Hey, what are your races? Give those a shout out while we're talking about them. You mentioned them. Which ones are they up there?
Our website is beaversracing.com, 3beaversracing.com, so people can look it up online. We have a number of different races. We just had a 100-miler, 100-mile, 100K, 50K, 25K that just happened this past weekend. And it's run through the night. And it's 100 miles of five-point UTMB race. So lots of elevation, very technical running. And it's all done at night. Well, you know, depending on how long it takes you, you know, you run the most of it at night. So that's just one of the events. But people can check out our website.
Very cool. We'll do. Hey, back to the kids for a second. What lessons are you trying to teach them? And I imagine it's different for each kid, but what are the things that you hope that they glean from the experience?
Well, first and foremost, in their own terms. So honestly, I don't hope to teach them anything. I want them to go on expedition and experience their own version of running the Sahara or their own version of my South Pole expedition, whatever. I want them to experience what I experienced on their own terms, not be influenced on the terms. They go there, they do it, they experience it, and they decide what it means to them. Right? So that's first and foremost. But also, through the process, and what I mean by that is it's not just the running every day, but there's content creation, curriculum development, working with, you know, we bring faculty on these expeditions, right? So it's not just these ambassadors. We bring teachers, we bring content creators, we bring photographers that teach them these different skills when they're out there so that they can communicate through these live websites or through social media, however we are communicating the expedition, because we change it every single time that we go out there. So I'm hoping that from that they learn skills. They learn things that they didn't know before, and they also learn that their capacity for work and to get things done is extraordinary, way more than what they thought.
You've had 1,000 or maybe over 1,000 kids out there. What's your finisher rate? I know in marathon, you know, ultra marathons, we might be 53% to 83%, depending on the day and the field. Have you had to send any kids back early?
Well, we've done 15 youth expeditions. Okay, so that's about 65 kids on expeditions. You know, in classrooms, that's tens of thousands of students have followed these expeditions. So right there, that's a success. You know, like this, the number of students that we've reached and impacted and shared curriculum with. But as far as the youth ambassadors go, of 65, I can think of only one or two incidences where maybe there was a dehydration issue or an injury where they had to ride. You know, they had to get in the four-wheel drive and go to next camp and reinvent what it is they do. But you know, sometimes those are the youth ambassadors that get the most out of it, because that's essentially what they have to. They're out there. We're in the middle of nowhere. It's not like you're going home. So they have to reinvent what it is their role is on the expedition. So they end up becoming assistant to the videographer or helping out the professors or whatever, right? So, or helping out their teammates. And, you know, it's hard to do, but it's a massive growth. So it's awesome.
Absolutely. You know, we learn more from the times that we figure out how we ended up dehydrated or why we ended up with a blister. We learn the most from our failures out there. When we get things right, we don't even know why they're right most of the time. We're just lucky to have dodged that particular bullet. So I know those kids that learn more when they have to reinvent themselves and reach deeper than they ever have. And there's no way out. There's no turning and just wanting to go home, because you're in the middle of a desert and days away from any help. So you've really got to reach down and reach to each other. I imagine the friendships and the camaraderie between those kids gets very, very strong, and they become lifelong friends.
Yeah, definitely they do. And, you know, some of the youth ambassadors, the alumni, you know, they work with each other within the organization volunteering. Others, they've got their own lives. You know, they're a lot of them are, you know, they're adults. And we've been doing this for many, many years now, right? So, you know, they've got their own lives. Some of them have kids now, families, blah, blah, blah. But we've retained a certain number of alumni that continue to help out. You know, I'm guiding. I have a guiding business as well called Capic One, where I take people back to some of the places I've been on expedition, and I slice out a week, and we go for a week, and we go and explore a place, right? So I've got alumni that are helping me out. One of them is a guide for me now. So she's hired as a guide on the winter Capic One expeditions. So you see, it's all full circle stuff, right?
Hey, when you're done with the expedition, do you sit down with the athlete, ambassador, student, and just have a conversation with them, or as a group? I'm interested in, and at the completion, how does that go down?
It's, again, it's one of those things, you guys have traveled a lot, you know, you're at the end of a race or whatever, and then you're going back to the airport with your buddies and your support crew, and there's ample time to talk before you get on your planes and fly home. That's typically what it is. It's very, again, Andy used that word organic because it's the most often used word in the world now, but that's pretty much what it is, right? It just kind of happens, you know, and everybody gets to hang out. There's usually a night or two at a hotel before we go home, and, you know, and that's, yeah, there's no solid, okay, now we must debrief. It's not who we are. There's other organizations that have strict process. We're just not that way. I don't want it to be that way. It's too complicated.
Yeah. Ray, you've been doing this for a while now. I work with youth and kind of see how our society has changed, and it seems like there's a lack of resiliency with not only youth, but even our adults. And I don't know, we could argue and talk about for 3 or 4 hours why that is, whether it's social media and unrealistic posts on social media or whatever. But it seems like we're less likely or inclined to do things that challenge us or do hard things. Are you seeing the same thing, and how can we help with that?
Well, interestingly, you know, I don't see exactly that. My feeling on it, and from what I've seen, I mean, given that I have the guiding company and these other things going on, I mean, all you have to do, dude, is go to Candace's races. They're full, right? Why are they full? Like, I mean, if you said to your buddies 5-6 years ago, hey, we should do a 200-mile race. They'd say, people don't run 200 miles. I've heard of 100-mile races. Go back 10 years ago. Hey, do you want to run a 100-miler? That's for crazy people. Go back 20 years ago. Let's go do a marathon. Nobody runs marathons, right? So slowly but surely over time, we have come to accept and understand that human endurance and our ability to do amazing things adventure-wise, all of us, is much more digestible. So that's why you're seeing people go and do 200-mile races. That's why the UTMB is jam-packed. You can't get in, right? Marathon des Sables, all these things. It's because people are saying, hey, I can do this. So I think that people are much more willing now to take a risk. I think from a resiliency perspective, if you're talking about our ability to be resilient in the face of challenge day to day, okay, that maybe is a different thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I have two daughters, and my 11-year-old is an amazing Nordic skier, cross-country skier, and my 8-year-old, she's into mountain biking. She's, you know, really gotten into it this year. They both trail run, but it's not a scenario. We have them both in soccer. Soccer's big where we live. It's big everywhere, and they both hated it. They couldn't stand it. I could see the stress in both my daughters, you know, being on that soccer pitch. It was exactly the same look on my face I had when I was a kid, that anxiety, the mm-hmm. pressure of, oh my God, ball, don't come to me, ball, don't come, you know, that anxiety, right? Yep. And I said to my wife, you know what, go back 50 years, my parents I'd have to stay out there because my parents paid for the soccer and I'm staying out there. We don't need to do this, you know? And so I take them out of the situation and on their own terms, you know, that we go and we do these things. We go down to the Adirondacks, we climb some mountains, we go on our little adventures with our family, and they love, they're taking off doing these other sports. That we're 11-year-old, she skis like an adult, right? But it's because the perspective we're taking is teach them resiliency through making basic decisions on or the direction that they want to go in through sports. I'm talking about sports, right? And right now, nothing else. And really trying to keep them outdoors, because I think that there's so much to learn. It's just like running has been my greatest teacher. Being outdoors is teaching these girls resiliency. It's teaching them when it's 40 below, you're going to go to ski practice anyhow, but she kind of wants to. It's not like being on the soccer pitch where she's like, I don't want to go. It's perfect weather. You know what I mean? It's like 40 below, but they're going to go on with the skiing. I want to be there. You know, it's that kind of stuff, right? So you learn to be resilient through pursuing certain things, and it's a skill like anything else.
If I'm a teacher and I want to get my students, my classroom, plugged into you, where do they go? What do they do?
Well, you know, we have a youth expedition planned for this fall in Ethiopia. We put the brakes on that one, just one of the regions that we were going to go to in Ethiopia. We were just, it wasn't coming together logistically. So we are planning our, we've shifted with the same youth ambassadors to a spring 2020 youth expedition. So I would say to teachers, you know, don't email us now. I don't know when this podcast is going live, but don't email us now because we're all volunteers and we're all doing other things. We're all hands on deck when it's go time. So next spring, start reaching out to us, you know, and we'll let you know what the web address is going to be, or just follow the Impossible to Possible Facebook page or my own social media. It's just @RaiseAhab is all my social medias, and I'll be posting about the next youth expedition when it comes. So in the weeks leading up, schools can tap in and say, oh, okay, we're ready to follow along. And there's no sign up. We used to do that. We used to, and what we realized was registration was a border, was an impediment to schools getting involved. So we said, let's remove that. It's on a website. Everybody can participate, yada, yada, yada. And we ended up getting more engagement that way because schools could, you know, step in, step out as they wanted to. They didn't have to do the whole curriculum. If they didn't want to, they could do a day, you know, and it makes it a lot easier.
Now, what if I'm a corporate sponsor and I want to donate and get involved that way because I see this is good? Do you have a path for them?
Yeah, just reach out to me. Just reach out to me directly on my website. I have a contact page on raiseahab.com, or reach out to me, direct message me on social. We'd love to talk with you. And donors are 501c3, so we're a charity in the United States of America, and we're a Canadian nonprofit. We'd love to talk with people, you know, and you know, we're primarily funded by corporate sponsorship. That's primarily how we're funded, but we do have donors that really believe in what we're doing, and annually they make a donation so that we can pull this thing off.
Nice.
Hey, Ray, thank you very much for reminding us that that impossible things can be possible, that reaching beyond your limits, doing tough things is good for your soul. It's good for your ego. It's good for your mental stability. And thank you very much for taking it to the next level and sharing it with other people. I think that's very commendable. So thank you very much.
Well, thanks, guys. And you know, I invite all of your listeners, your millions and millions of listeners, because I know at last count there's like 40 million or something like that.
Pretty close. Yeah. Like, give or take 40
so
million.
Something like that. I'm 40, 41. If they get a chance, follow along on either my social media or my website. I've got a couple of my own expeditions coming up that'll be pretty rad. I'm doing a solo unsupported January expedition in the Canadian Arctic in a region that's pretty amazing. It'll be partly on the frozen Arctic Ocean and then up over some mountains on Baffin Island. So it's going to be a really cool trip, and I'll be uploading stuff directly by satellite. And it's incredible there in the winter. I mean, I just can't tell you how cold it is. So that'll be really amazing. And then I have another couple of big projects planned for 2020 myself as well. So could be some cool stuff there and ways for schools to align and follow along and engage with me on those projects as well.
Hey, Ray, which is tougher on these unsupported solo expeditions? The actual getting from point A to point B, or creating the content and taking your hands out of the gloves in 40 degree below zero weather and turning on the camera and making sure the batteries are charged?
Yeah, you know what? Everything. Winter Arctic expeditions are so insanely difficult. And I mean, you don't sleep because polar bears, right? So you're always concerned, right? And so it's they're dangerous, and it's dark or dark a lot of the time. And so the expeditions have so many factors, so many elements that you don't even think about on a more hot weather expedition. But I'll say when we crossed the Namib Desert, I did it with my buddy Stefano Gregoretti. That was in kilometers. It was 1,850 kilometers, or even this Death Valley Transect that I did west to east this past summer. You know, that was so difficult because the heat is oppressive. The terrain is oppressive. Everything's oppressive. So it makes it equally difficult, but in a different way. So but Arctic expeditions, everything freezing, your body, your hands, everything, including your gear and your SATCOMs, it's very difficult. And you're hauling everything in an Arctic expedition, everything you need. Whereas on the hot expeditions, like in Death Valley, we relied on Cassius. And then in Namibia, we would have a resupply whenever we could reach people. So maybe, you know, running 40 miles a day or whatever it is, we would get 2 resupplies a day kind of thing, you know, depending on the day.
Well, we'll make sure that we link all of your contact, your social media channels, websites, and stuff to the show notes.
One more question, Scott.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right. You didn't know I had a question. What's more difficult? And I know it really depends on the time, place, whatever. But the hot stuff or the cold stuff?
The cold stuff.
Yeah.
The cold stuff, because there's so many additional factors that hamper your ability. Guys, this past year, when I attempted to cross Kamchatka, I 4 years of planning, a lifetime of dreaming of going to this place, right? And we get there 20 days unsupported on the expedition. No one else there, just Stefano and I. We left the West Coast, we're on our own. We climb over a mountain range on our way, very sketchy, climbing over this. We haul in our sleds, get over the other side. We are 60, 70 miles from the east coast of Kamchatka, because we've got this crazy thing going on with our world right now, with climate patterns shifting and fluctuations in temperature. There was a warming trend, and all of the rivers, the network of frozen rivers that I would need to cross to complete the expedition, braids of rivers that were a mile wide in some cases, were open. And so the expedition was over. Done. So, you know, saved for this expedition. It was my focus, my training focus for 2 years was to go on that expedition. I had gone to Namibia and did that expedition in preparation, but still basically spent a year and a half, 2 years training for this one thing, you know, and the funding and everything else. And it's done. And it was completely unpredictable. Whereas, you know, I used the Namib Desert because it was the last large desert that I've crossed, you know. Yeah, we had to make alterations in the northern part of the Namib Desert because of landmines and that sort of thing as we reached the Angolan border. But, you know, we could change trajectory if we needed to. On these Arctic projects, it's very difficult. You're all in or you're all out, you know?
Well, there are tropical beaches to go to and run around too, right?
I want to circumnavigate the Big Island, and that's my expedition.
Actually, you know what? That would be epic, and it would be beautiful too. I've never been to Hawaii. I'd love to go and check that out.
Yes, sign me up, but leave me off the list for polar bears and scorpions and poisonous snakes. Don't need that to crawl into bed with me at night. Scott, take us out.
Hey, Ray, thanks again. We appreciate your time and your story and your mission. Hopefully it'll inspire those who are listening to this to do something difficult on their own and maybe go grab somebody by the arm and bring them along with them.
So, you know, I appreciate it. And thanks for the time, guys, and to everyone out there. You know, never underestimate what you can do. You know, just taking risks and taking chances is actually a good thing. I mean, you got to plan it out. You plan your risk out. But taking a risk now and then, it's good for us. You know?
Nice. Now go out and risk
mass.